Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to the 146th edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, my longtime partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Hello, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Laura, since our last broadcast, five Republican presidential candidates took part in their third televised debate, this one in Miami. Yes, we are going to be talking about that. But since last night, late Sunday night, that candidate field has been reduced by one. U.S. Senator Tim Scott suspended his campaign last night, saying voters have been clear to him, telling him, not now, Tim. So, Laura, what was it about Tim Scott's candidacy that eventually led to its end? Why did it have to end this early?
Well, a lot of senators have run for president and very few have ever been elected. I think that Barack Obama and Joe Biden are really the only ones in recent memory. And of course, Joe Biden was the vice president after he was in the Senate. So it's not an easy position to run from. And Tim Scott was just the candidate a lot of people liked, but they in the Republican Party, but he was the first choice of very, very few. And he was trying to appeal to social conservative voters, evangelical Christians, but so were most of the other candidates in the field. And he just wasn't getting any traction. I should say that I read last night that his own campaign staff were shocked by this announcement. He was live being interviewed on a show, and they did not know it was coming. And it was only a few weeks ago that he announced he was going all in for Iowa. He moved a bunch of his campaign staffers to Iowa. And so now, after uprooting their lives, they're going to be having to go back home.
He had just made it clear he was going to spend millions of dollars in Iowa. Well, he will not now. And you might be wondering, which candidate benefits from Scott's departure in upcoming Iowa caucuses? The Des Moines Register has the answer in tomorrow's newspaper. Nobody's going to benefit.
Well, it's always difficult. I mean, his support, the number of people who said he was their first choice was a fairly small percentage. But among those who were leaning towards supporting Tim Scott, it was a real split ticket. So 28% said Trump was their second choice, 25% Nikki Haley, 23% Ron DeSantis. So really, it doesn't look like anybody clearly benefits. I will say that when we get to the third contest on the Republican side, which is going to be in South Carolina, this should benefit Nikki Haley probably more than anyone else because, of course, they both had most of their political careers in South Carolina.
So if you were to spread out Tim Scott's support among those three candidates that you just mentioned, Donald Trump will still lead in Iowa with 45%. Haley and DeSantis would each have 18%. Actually, they're farther behind if Tim Scott leads.
Yes, in theory. I mean, a lot can change. And I still think that Trump has a strong potential to outperform his polling numbers because he's drawing the biggest crowds. And I think that he is more likely to bring in first-time caucus goers, people who have not participated in the caucuses in the past.
All right, let's move on to Miami. Five Republican GOP presidential hopefuls clashed in Miami last week over Israel, abortion, and foreign policy. Donald Trump skipped the debate, and Nikki Haley called Vivek Ramaswamy scum. Those are some of the highlights. Let's talk about Nikki Haley. She was perceived by many to be the winner. She was very, very strong last week.
Yes, I saw in one of the post-debate polls among Republicans that Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis were named by people as saying that they thought they won the debate. But Nikki Haley gained a little bit more support than DeSantis did, even though there were quite a few viewers who thought that DeSantis had a strong performance. And I think that she's still walking that line. She is emphasizing foreign policy. Of course, the current events going on globally play to her strengths in foreign policy, having been a former UN ambassador. But she's also playing for that moderate vote. I thought it was very interesting, and we talked about this before, the way she discusses abortion. She says that she's pro-life, but she doesn't judge people who are pro-choice, and she hopes that they don't judge her. And she said, we need to talk about this issue differently. And it's interesting just the fact that she says pro-choice. Most Republican politicians who favor banning abortion don't use that phrase. They'll accuse their political opponents of being pro-abortion. And there is still a sizable part of the Republican base that is more moderate on that issue. And I think that she is capitalizing on that, and she continued on that track.
She and Ramaswamy clearly do not like each other. She called Ramaswamy scum during a contentious moment over TikTok, of all things. She also said that Russia and China's leaders are salivating at the thought that someone like Ramaswamy could become president. There is no love lost there.
Well, I don't think any of the other candidates really like Vivek Ramaswamy very much. I mean, Donald Trump seems to like him the most, and he's not attending any of these debates. But Vivek Ramaswamy is trying to distinguish himself on foreign policy by opposing further aid to Ukraine. He has a slightly different position on the Middle East. He says Israel should be self-sufficient. And I think that is something, I mean, that was part of their disagreement. That's why Nikki Haley said that foreign leaders would be salivating over him possibly becoming president. I thought it was very amusing that TikTok, Republican candidates are falling all over themselves, promising to ban TikTok and bashing TikTok. And yet TikTok bought TV ads during the debate. So in several of the commercial breaks, you could see ads for what a great company TikTok was. So I thought that was interesting. But Ramaswamy, the reason why Nikki Haley called him scum was that he had pointed out that she talks about banning TikTok, and yet her own daughter uses TikTok. And she said, you know, you keep my daughter out of your voice. She was very unhappy that he referenced her daughter. And then when he continued on that track, that's when she said, you're just scum.
Ron DeSantis, still trying to hold on to second place, said that Trump had failed to build the border wall, had racked up federal debt, had set the Republican Party on a path of electoral defeat. In fact, he said he was sick of Republicans losing. So said Ron DeSantis.
Yes, and the debate occurred last Wednesday, so it was a day after an election that had a lot of disappointing results for Republicans, from failing to take control of the Virginia State House and Senate to losing the abortion referendum in Ohio, and a number of disappointing results for them in school board races. I think it's interesting when you consider what the other candidates will criticize Donald Trump about. So this is the second time, I think, that Ron DeSantis has criticized Donald Trump for not participating in the debates. He and Nikki Haley have both criticized Trump for running up deficits when he was president. They do not criticize any of his proposals. I mean, you may have seen in the news in the last week the way Donald Trump has talked about some of his political opponents, using dehumanizing rhetoric, comparing them to vermin, talking about planning to replace a lot of government officials with political loyalists to him. I mean, a lot of things that are very anti-democratic, and yet that's not something that any of the other Republicans in the field will criticize Donald Trump over. Chris Christie does criticize his many criminal indictments, but really it's interesting to me that they don't, most of the rest of the field, there are certain areas that they still seem afraid to criticize Donald Trump.
Ramaswamy was all over the place. He called on Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel to step down after GOP electoral losses last Tuesday, called the GOP a party of losers, attacked the corrupt media establishment, challenged NBC's Kristen Welker, and he even called Ukrainian President Zelensky, quote, a comedian in cargo pants. He was all over.
Yeah, well, in his opening statement, he sort of came right out of the gate attacking the Republican National Committee chair. He talked about all of the losses that the Republican Party has had since she became the chair in 2016. And then attacking the media right out of the gate was an interesting strategy. I mean, I think one of the problems Ramaswamy has is that he's trying to be the most Trump-like candidate with Trump absent on the stage. And of course, the voters who like that are for the most part, supporting Donald Trump. They're not supporting Ramaswamy. So what we see in the post-debate opinion polls of Republican voters, and we saw it again, that Ramaswamy is the most disliked candidate. I mean, a lot of people are not liking what they see. And I think the people who like that very aggressive, in-your-face style are generally going to be Trump supporters. So I don't know where he's going with this. I mean, he seems to be kind of playing the internet troll of the field. I saw last night on social media, he threw out a new proposal that he would eliminate half of the federal workforce on the first day by saying, if your social security number ends in an odd number, you're fired. And I mean, that's just not realistic at all. It's not how anything works, right? So you just really wonder what he is in it for.
Laura, my social security number ends in an odd number. Does that mean I'm fired?
I don't know. Mine ends in an even number, Dennis. So I guess I'm safe.
Very briefly, Chris Christie, and we did not much to talk about with Tim Scott since he's dropped out. Christie had some very good moments, by the way. He did talk about Trump's legal challenges with multiple upcoming federal trials as disqualifying him from becoming president. He said, and this was a good quote, anybody who's going to be spending the next year and a half of their life focusing on keeping themselves out of jail and courtrooms cannot lead this party or this country.
I thought it was interesting, the polls. So Chris Christie generally is viewed unfavorably by the Republican electorate, but the polls show that people had very negative expectations, but that he didn't do poorly. He didn't do worse after the debate than before. So actually, a lot of people thought that he did reasonably well. He's still not the first choice of very many Republican voters, but still, I mean, I thought that was interesting. For me, I thought an interesting moment for Chris Christie was when they were, all of the candidates were asked about Islamophobia. And I mean, there were several questions related to what's going on in the Middle East. And Ron DeSantis just said, this is crazy. I mean, the Biden administration, they're talking about Islamophobia. That's not the problem. The problem is anti-Semitism. Well, the Biden administration is talking about both. And Chris Christie said, I understand this. I've worked in this area before because President George W. Bush appointed him U.S. attorney in New Jersey on September 10th, 2001. So he talked about all of the work that his office did with the Muslim community. New Jersey is a very diverse state, very large Muslim community, of course, also a very large Jewish community. And he talked about the work. I thought that that was a strong moment for him.
We're going to bottom line this in order to zoom ahead. This probably did not change, this last debate. The calculus here, Trump is still way ahead. DeSantis and Haley are fighting for second. Haley's about to go all out with a 10 million ad buy in Iowa and New Hampshire. It's really coming down in Iowa to Haley and DeSantis for second place.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, and this was partly true before the 2016 caucuses, but I think it's even more true now, that it used to be that the role of the Iowa caucuses was to winnow the field. And now we're seeing the field is substantially winnowed even before anybody goes into the Iowa caucuses. And part of it is the RNC and these rules that they've had for debates. And part of it is just the fact, the reality that Trump is the de facto incumbent in this field. And so it's not really as wide open a race as you would imagine.
The next Republican debate is December 6th in Tuscaloosa, but there's more. Family Leader President and CEO Bob Vanderplas of Iowa said his group is moving forward with a planned Thanksgiving forum, really this coming Friday, November 17th. DeSantis, Scott, and Ramaswamy had agreed to come. Scott's out, so I guess it's going to be a sit-down with DeSantis and Ramaswamy.
And there was a little bit of brinksmanship here because the RNC was saying, no, anybody who participates in this family leader event is going to be excluded from debates. There are going to be sanctions because they want to make sure that they have control over what happens in the debates. And so that's why he said, oh, look, this isn't a debate. We're just going to have the candidates one after another. This is going to be quite different from in July when they had their forum and a much larger group of candidates were there. Now, also, they didn't invite all of the candidates. I think family leader has their own criteria for who they invited. And so they didn't invite any of the candidates who are polling very low down. And so, as you mentioned, Trump is not going to be there. As far as we know, Nikki Haley has not confirmed, and Tim Scott is, of course, out of the race. So it looks like if you want to see Ron DeSantis or Vivek Ramaswamy at the Family Leader Forum, you still have time to get tickets.
But that's not all, because Randy Feenstra is going to have his own conversation, which he announced this afternoon. This one coming up in Sioux Center on December 9th, and there are five candidates coming, including Texas pastor Ryan Binkley. I don't know why, because he's doing 0%, but he's coming.
Yes, and as well as North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. So Randy Feenstra, I think, is still in the invite everybody mode, even if they're not qualifying for the debates. Doug Burgum is still spending quite a lot of money, has still seen my contacts are still occasionally receiving direct mail from him, and he still has some TV ads on. But yes, so he is having, this is the traditional role of the caucuses. I mean, it really is a big help to local candidates and party committees, county committees, and in this case, a member of Congress, really helps them sell tickets for their own fundraisers.
And very quickly, before we have to take a short break here, Joe Manchin announced last week, Democratic senator from West Virginia, he is not going to seek re-election, and that sets back Democrats' plans to hold on to their Senate majority. But the more important question, at least the more overwhelming question, is who does he hurt if he runs as a third-party candidate, Biden or Trump? And there are other people running as third-party candidates. This could be a mess, Laura.
Well, there are quite a lot of third-party candidates, and normally opinion polls overstate support for third party. So I don't usually pay a lot of attention to the polls, but I will mention that the 2016 presidential election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump saw the highest third-party vote in recent memory. So there were about, the combined vote for all the third-party candidates was about 4.5%. This time we've got Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He is going to have a fairly well-funded campaign. Jill Stein is sounding like she's going to run on the Green Party ticket again. Professor Cornell West is running. And as you mentioned, Joe Manchin, I actually lean toward the view that he may not try to be a candidate on the ballot himself, but who knows? So, I mean, it could be that we have a relatively high vote for third party candidates, but I'd still be really surprised if it ends up being more than 5% nationally. But it could still be crucial in some states. I mean, there were definitely states, I think Wisconsin was one, where the third party vote in 2016 was greater than the margin between Clinton and Trump.
Just another fast-paced show because so many things are going on in American politics. It is 15 and a half after the hour. This is KHOI's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We are indeed going to step out for just a short time now because my friend Tom Beal of KHOI, he's been with KHOI for years, is going to tell us why it's important to support this radio station. You're my old buddy, Tom, so go ahead.
All right. Well, Dennis and Laura, thanks for this insightful discussion of all the campaigns going on simultaneously and at cross purposes. Yes, this is the opportunity for you, our listener, to support the station and support programs like this one. Now, this is our regular fundraising period, but we are also encouraging people to invite their friends and family to listen, to become listeners. Sample the station. See what you think. We're hoping that as more people tune in, they will be motivated to contribute to the station's operating funds, and we'll expand our offerings even greater than they are now. So that's the goal this time. Please invite people to listen and then write a check or go online and can make a contribution to the station. We need every penny to keep going. Michael, what is the proper online site to go to?
You can go to khoifm.org/membership and make your contribution there. It's the swift and secure way to do so.
Right. We hope that you value what you're hearing as much as we value putting it on the air. And if so, please make a contribution. And again, talk up the station to your friends and the family and say, give it a chance. We have a complicated schedule. You can go online and see all the many offerings, all the many programs we feature. So khoifm.org/membership and become a part of the KHOI family.
Mr. Beal and Mr. Murphy, thank you very much. And we are back now, Laura Bellin and I. We have a few minutes left to talk about a ton of stuff. Last week, let's talk about Israel. Iowa's four GOP congressional members voted to censure Rashida Tlaib of Michigan for incendiary remarks that she has made regarding the Israel-Hamas war.
Yes, and this is something that has been going back and forth. We had talked about there was a previous censure vote where Marionette Miller-Meeks voted with Democrats to table that motion. But in this case, it was a mostly party line vote and with some Democrats joining the Republicans on the censure resolution. Most of the Democrats in the House felt that this was an infringement on Rashida Tlaib's speech and freedom of expression.
But wait, there's more coming from the U.S. House as soon as this Friday because a shutdown is looming. I know you've heard this before, and that got Kevin McCarthy kicked out eventually as House Speaker. But can new House Speaker Mike Johnson avoid a government shutdown come Friday?
Well, it's hard to really understand his strategy that he sent Congress home over this past weekend, even though we were less than a week away from a shutdown. And I thought, well, wow, I don't really see how the House and Senate can get on the same page in time for Friday. I will say that the congressional reporters I follow have been saying within the last 24 hours or so, it does seem like some kind of a deal on a continuing resolution is coalescing. It could be that, as with Kevin McCarthy, this is a deal that ultimately passes with some Republican and some Democratic votes and then some conservative holdouts. And the question is, will these holdouts give Mike Johnson a pass on what they use as an excuse to toss out Kevin McCarthy as speaker? But so I'm not sure. I mean, we could be spending next Monday talking about a shutdown, but it does look like maybe there will be some sort of temporary funding deal that will come together in the next few days.
One of the Washington Post writers last week described the U.S. House as being a den of recriminations because so many things are going on in the House that are so negative. Everybody just slashing each other. So you might wonder who in the world would want to be a congressperson. Well, there's somebody who announced he does want to be a congressperson from the 3rd Congressional District in Iowa.
Yes. So Lanon Bacom, and we had discussed this before, that he had said he was exploring the race, but he made it official last week. He is running against Zach Nunn in the 3rd District. This is the least Republican-leaning of Iowa's 4 districts. So it has a partisan voting index of about R+3, which means compared to the national electorate, it voted about 3 points more Republican. Zach Nunn, of course, former member of the Iowa legislature who defeated Cindy Axne by less than 1% of the vote in 2022. And Lanon Bacom, I had thought, well, there it looks like we're going to have a competitive Democratic primary here because I had heard that several other Democrats were thinking about this race. But within minutes of his announcement, they rolled out endorsements from former Governor Tom Vilsack, former First Lady Kristi Vilsack, and State Auditor Rob Sand. And then within a day or two after that, they rolled out several dozen endorsements, including current and former state legislators, former leaders of the state party, other former statewide elected officials. So at this point, I think we may end up having Lanon become unchallenged for the Democratic nomination in the 3rd District. We'll have to see.
All of those endorsements designed to keep other Democratic candidates out if possible. Now, Mr. Bacom is almost completely unknown. Now, all it takes to become known is millions of dollars in television advertising. You think he's going to have it?
Well, he said he raised about $250,000 on the first day of his campaign. And so, I mean, he certainly, that's a very, very solid start. I think that was the most money that a first-time congressional challenger has raised in the first 24 hours of their campaign. So we'll see. But as you say, it does cost millions of dollars. And one big question mark is how much will the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and other Democratic aligned groups like the House Majority PAC, how much will they get involved in the 3rd District? There are dozens of House seats that look like they may flip one way or the other next year. And so there's going to be a lot of competition for where that money is going to be spent. I should say, Lanon Bacom, I mean, he grew up in Mount Pleasant. He comes from a small town background. He served in the military, including in a combat role. He also has served in state government and in the federal government, most recently working for the USDA. And so Democrats feel that he has a very attractive biography and that once Iowans get to know him, they're going to like what they see.
And briefly, Democratic candidate Christina Bohannon in the 1st District got an endorsement last week from Emily's List that is not a surprise.
That's right. Emily's List supported her in the last campaign. Emily's List is one of the leading PACs that supports Democratic candidates. Specifically, they support pro-choice Democratic women running for office. And one thing that's helpful, it's not just the money that Emily's List directly donates to a candidate, but it's opening up their donor list. Their website will list the candidates they're supporting. And that can help a candidate like Christina Bohannon get support from donors all over the country.
We have three major things we want to get to before the end of the program. So first one is that last week during the election, voters in several large Iowa school districts elected progressive and or candidates backed by the teachers union over their conservative opponents on Tuesday night. It was almost a rout.
It really was. Compared to 2 years ago when we talked about the 2021 local elections, it was a real mixed bag. So there were some districts like West Des Moines and Waukee where the progressive candidates won, and then there were other districts like Ankeny and Johnston in the suburbs of Des Moines that were a sweep for the conservatives. And this year, almost in all of the districts, all of the major, the largest 15 or 20 districts in the state was a sweep for the Democratic candidates. And one of the trends that we're seeing now in school board races is these informal slates. So if there are three seats up for the election, there will be six candidates, three backed by the teachers union and three conservative. If there are four seats on the ballot, there will be eight candidates and two clear slates. And we saw that playing out not just in the Des Moines area, Des Moines suburbs, but in places in Council Bluffs, in Mason City, in Cedar Rapids, and especially Lynmar, which was at the epicenter of conservative criticism of what they saw as woke policies at the school board level. So it was a pretty large repudiation of some of the Republican critique of Iowa school boards.
And there were other things that took place last week. Voters approved a $350 million bond issue to build a new terminal at the Des Moines Airport. Waukee voters approved a bond issue to upgrade school facilities in Gilbert. Voters approved a $35 million bond issue. And in Pella, Laura, a very interesting vote over whether to give the council more sway over books.
This was a surprising vote to me. Pella is one of the most conservative towns in Iowa, and this was something that conservatives had pushed to have this ballot initiative that would allow the city council to overrule the library board. Specifically, they were unhappy that the library board rejected their request to remove the book Genderqueer from the library's adult section. And I honestly didn't think that there was much of a chance that this referendum could be defeated, but it was. It was a narrow margin, but it was a 51% to 49% margin, even in a very conservative community like Pella. They voted to preserve the independence of the library board, and that was something that was very encouraging to people around the state. It was a very closely watched local referendum, and I was told by people in Pella that turnout was fairly high compared to recent city elections. So this was quite a statement.
Abortion back in the news in Iowa last week. It will be again this coming week. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd last week filed the state's legal argument on abortion to the state Supreme Court on Wednesday.
Yes, and we already knew that the state was appealing that decision, the lower court decision that put the new near-total abortion ban on hold. This was just the brief that fleshed out the legal arguments. They're mostly very technical about what the standard of review should be, and basically they're saying that the Iowa Supreme Court should use the same standard the U.S. Supreme Court used in the Dobbs decision, and said that the state only needs to have a rational basis for abortion restrictions that would basically allow almost any limits.
And later this week, Friday to be exact, the Iowa Board of Medicine is set to consider administrative rules related to the state's abortion ban.
Yes. So the Iowa Board of Medicine was allowed to proceed with administrative rulemaking while the law was on hold. That way, they'll be ready to go in case the Iowa Supreme Court allows the law to be enforced. And I looked, so these rules are mostly explaining and under what circumstances can a physician in Iowa perform an abortion if it is if the pregnancy was the result of either rape or incest. There are other provisions of the law that was passed in July that have to do with medical emergency, and those are not subject. That's not the topic addressed in these draft administrative rules. So I'm trying to clarify whether the Iowa Board of Medicine is going to consider different administrative rules to talk about that portion of the law at a later date.
And very briefly, you wrote on Bleeding Heartland about why Iowa Democrats cannot force a statewide vote on abortion like the one that passed last week in the state of Ohio.
Yes, I've had some reader questions about that, and that's why I wanted to explain. So compared to a lot of other states, the Iowa Constitution is very difficult to amend. And in most cases, it requires legislative action. Two separately elected legislatures have to pass the same language through the Iowa House and the Iowa Senate. And then after a general election, the next legislature has to go and do it again. So we don't have a process like what they had in Michigan and Ohio, and what people are trying to do now in states like Missouri, Nebraska, Arizona, Florida, to try to force an initiative, a specific amendment, to be on the ballot. There's just no way this can happen. And I just wanted to make that clear because there was a lot of confusion. I had some readers say, but why can't we have a vote on reproductive rights when we just had this vote on gun rights? Well, the difference is the Iowa legislature passed twice through the House and the Senate that strict scrutiny amendment about the right to bear arms in Iowa. So that happened through legislative action. So if the Iowa House and Senate don't want to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, it's not going to be there. And currently, under this Republican-controlled legislature, I think there's no way, after seeing what happened in the other states that have voted on abortion, there is no way that they will put any kind of an abortion amendment on the ballot. And I want to clarify that Iowa and Ohio are very similar in terms of the Republican lean. They both have a partisan voting index of about R+6 as a state. That means that compared to the national vote, the Iowa and Ohio presidential vote in the last two elections were about 6 points more Republican. So that abortion rights amendment passed by a double-digit margin in Ohio, and it's a safe bet that if it were on the ballot in Iowa, it probably would pass, but there's no way for voters to get it on the ballot.
And very quickly, like in 40 seconds here, the Summit pipeline permit decision in Iowa for the pipeline Summit Carbon Solutions wants to build is not expected to be made until next year, but that may not be the end of it.
That's right. So they concluded the evidentiary hearing that had gone on for a couple of months now, more than that, in Fort Dodge. They had thousands of exhibits, hundreds of witnesses, and now both sides are going to have the opportunity to file briefs. There is no deadline for the Iowa Utilities Board to make a decision, so we don't know exactly when it will come. It certainly won't be in 2023. There will likely be litigation ongoing after that, and not only related directly to the pipeline, but also to the water permits that Summit Carbon Solutions, that LLCs affiliated with Summit, are trying to get water permits so that it can build carbon capture facilities. So this thing is not going to be resolved anytime soon.
We're out of time, Laura. You have a great week.
You too, Dennis.
A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back here in the same time slot next week, and as usual, we're going to talk about everything interesting or important or even entertaining that takes place in Iowa politics. And as always, we hope you can join us. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and extremely happy week.